Mrs. Bird Note. A typical house finch song has a raspy edge and tumbles forward in a jumbled series of notes. Especially during breeding season, the song has a sharp, buzzy note, like at the end of this one. In parts of the United States, house finches overlap with similar-looking purple finches. Their distinct songs help us sort them out. Compared with house finch songs, purple finch songs are faster and roll along smoothly as a brisk series of warbled phrases. And purple finches don't throw in that sharp, buzzy note that tags many house finch songs. Purple finches in the West sing a little differently from those in the East. But these variations are much more similar to each other than to house finch songs. Let's listen again. House finch, jumbled. Purple finch, smooth. But both are music to the ears. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. This episode is brought to you by Wild Delight Bird Food, which aims to support wild bird populations with clean, nutritious ingredients in every blend. Available at Chewy.com.
You can deny all the things I've seen, all the things I've discovered, but not for much longer. Because too many others know what's happening out there.
Hi, this is David Duchovny, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby.
It is only through a change in human consciousness that the world will be transformed. The personal and the planetary are connected. As we expand our awareness of mind, body, psyche, and spirit, and bring that awareness actively into the world, so also will the world be changed. This is our quest as we explore new dimensions.
We're all familiar with the saying, we are all in this together, without fully appreciating what that actually means. This means that we are all being affected by and are affecting everyone and everything around us, often outside of our conscious awareness. Today, we'll explore how we're swimming as in an ocean of a universe suffused with fields of energy. These fields have visible, measurable effects on us as individuals, as families, as groups, and as communities. Becoming more aware of these energetic fields allows us to make conscious choices about the impact we want to have. Such choices can become the steps toward a just and compassionate world. Guiding us today are Drs. Alan Briskin and Mary Jalinas. Alan Briskin has a doctorate in organizational psychology and is a pioneer in the field of organizational learning. He's the co-founder of the Collective Wisdom Initiative and has been consultant to many large corporations, including Lucasfilms, Sutter Health, Kaiser Permanente, and the Goy Peace Foundation. He's the author and co-author of many books, including The Power of Collective Wisdom and The Trap of Collective Folly. Mary V. Jalinas has a doctorate in education and is an organization development consultant devoted to the art of conscious social change. She's the author of Talk Matters, Saving the World, One Word at a Time. Briskin and Jalinas are co-authors of Space Is Not Empty, How Hidden Fields Are Shaping Your Life and Our World. So please join us for the next hour as we explore how to recognize and have a positive effect on the invisible energetic fields in which we are immersed with our guests, Dr. Alan Briskin and Mary V. Jalinas. I'm speaking with Alan and Mary in their homes by remote connection. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. I'll be your host. Welcome to New Dimensions. Alan, Mary, welcome.
Thank you.
Hi, Justine.
Yeah, happy to be here, Justine.
I'm so glad to have you. First of all, I would love for you to say something about your stories. As consultants to organizations, there was a moment that you realized that it was something more was going on. There were energetic fields going on. So tell us, Alan, I'll start with you. When did that first occur to you, that there are fields of energy?
Well, it was very early on that I was trained to do organizational consulting. A lot of that has to do with the conscious effort to get people to cooperate more and talk honestly with each other, design meetings in more constructive ways. But I felt that there was something else going on, that I was swimming, to use the metaphor, in waters that none of us were seeing, and it had to do with the atmosphere and feel of the time together. And I could see how even one comment can either puncture a group or move it forward. And so I was trying to find language for myself that got closer to the bone, that got closer to what was really going on in these group encounters. And my first exposure to fields was in Meg Wheatley's book, Leadership in the New Science, which was in 1992. And that began like a seed that was planted, began to sort of sprout inside of me.
Beautiful, beautiful. Mary, what was your first inkling that there was some invisible field of energy going on?
Well, it came through a fortuitous meeting with Alan at a conference, and he and a dear colleague and friend, David Sibbett, were actually tracing the history of field theory. And Alan was, you know, going through his sort of historical references, and I was eavesdropping, you know, as David was doing his beautiful graphic recording on the wall of paper. And as I listened, I realized that it wasn't just a realization. It was actually like a lightning bolt that went through my body. Because for years, I had been working to create collaboration within organizations, within communities, among organizations. And I had, in my first book, try to integrate what we are learning from brain science and the impact of contemplative practices on the brain and therefore on our behavior. And what I realized was that even though I had always considered the context within which those collaborative conversations were occurring, this was something different, more nuanced, more deeper, expansive of what Alan was talking about. So I kind of jumped into the conversation and connected immediately because I saw something that was really needed. It was a missing link, I guess I would say.
And the field was created between Mary and I. you know, that I had been working with conceptual material, Jung's collective unconscious, Bohm's implicate order, Sheldrake's morphogenic fields. I also understood it in my body, but I hadn't yet had someone to really be in dialogue with it. And Mary stepped forward and it was the lightning bolt, but it was a deep intuition that we were talking about something more than context, more than culture. And it was through the dialogue, which occurred over 7 years remotely, but once, twice a week, beginning every session with what was just emerging in our own lives and connecting it to fields, So the book is really an outcome of a field that Mary and I created together.
How wonderful. And what I get from your writings is that you're taking that quantum field theory in physics and applying it to the social scene, so to speak, that you're really bringing it, making it available to us, like we're not thinking about protons or neurons or quarks or anything. We're thinking about how we relate to one another. And so you talk about three relational fields. So please help us understand. The first one is the personal field. So help us understand that.
Yeah.
So the personal field for me is the source of perceiving internally and externally the body. So the personal field for me is our body sensations, our emotions, our thoughts. And what's key is being able to witness or to observe, not from a distance, but being with all of that as clues to what's going on inside and what's going on outside. So for me, the personal field is the ability to is really key to our own personal agency. So we're not being driven outside of our conscious awareness, oftentimes by the more primitive parts of the brain. So the personal field for me is the entry point. It's the source of perception of the fields. So that's the first one.
Can I just say something
Please.
About that? Because in your writing, I remember reading and I thought, oh, this is really important. Because in being aware of this personal field, the brain, which is so analytical,
yes.
is so quick to analyze the situation. It just goes right, boom, it's there. And you're saying, both of you are saying, slow it down. Feel how your body is actually responding to this field.
Well, I'm so glad you're bringing that forward, because very much that's exactly what we're saying about the personal field. That in Buddhist language, there's an expression before knowing, and what it refers to is the tendency of the analytic mind to always give something a name or a category. And to step back behind that is to step back into the body, step back into silence. And insights arise from a different realm than just the analytic mind operating. And that we knew early on when we talked with people about fields, and we were talking to hundreds of people, that either they didn't quite grasp the significance of field, or they had their own language for it. Oh, is it like Sheldrake's morphogenic field? You mean this? Do you mean that? And so we came up with these distinctions within one unifying field. They're not separate fields. The personal field, social, and noetic are all one field in which we are embraced by. And the personal field, consistent with our way of describing fields, is a boundary where interactions that are both visible and invisible take place. So the personal field is bounded by our skin. And it's what takes place within that frame and a few feet beyond it. And then one could say through an extended mind, even beyond that. And so everything from your thoughts to your unconscious activity at night constitute the personal field. So it's a arena of inquiry and forever discovery, because there's both what the conscious mind brings forward and then what the unconscious connection to the environment brings forward.
I remember a moment when I was standing in line at a bank and I'm fine. And suddenly I just felt invaded by some energy. And I turned around and behind me was a person who looked like their origins were from Asia. And I realized in that moment that as an American, we have a huge personal field that it's very big. And if you're growing up in a
culture that is more crowded, you know, that is, people are having to be crowded together, and we're getting more and more like that now. But anyway, that they don't, their personal field is much smaller. And I just really got that there, that's when I really realized there is, there are fields of energy.
Very good. Mary, you want to say something?
Yeah, that is such a great example, because I remember getting into an elevator in Hong Kong years ago, and it was like, oh my goodness, everybody's standing so close to me. And, you know, and I was head and shoulders above everybody else because I'm tall. and, you know, it's interesting that you said that, Justine. I don't know. It raises a question in my mind whether their personal field is smaller or whether they're just used to have people so close to them in their personal field. I don't know the answer to that, but it raises an interesting question in my mind.
Exactly.
About it. Yeah.
And I think, again, it's wonderful, because we need to be careful about how we name or create adjectives to the personal field. What I certainly pick up is it was an experience of realizing that you have a field around you, and that a boundary had been impinged upon.
Yes.
I can have that experience if someone is talking to me and comes closer and closer to my face. And they're talking, you know, right in front of my face. I, all of a sudden, my body responds to that because I'm not used to that movement into my personal space.
And so what you're saying is to become aware in our body how it's responding to that. What is the second field? I think you call it the social field.
Yeah.
The social field is not simply a combination of our personal fields. It's really our personal fields and the energy and information that arises in groups. It's also in the spaces that we are in. You know, for example, think about the difference in a conversation you might be having walking in the woods versus being in the boss's office, or you're sitting around your kitchen table. All of those spaces have different energies to them and therefore will be affecting you. And it's also the history of the place, the history of the land. You know, I live in Humboldt County, where 9 Native American tribes live. And one of those tribes was nearly wiped out in the 1850s. So our land here, the land that I experience, I think still holds that attempt at genocide. So it really is, it's what arises among us, what arises around us, and what is already embedded in the spaces in which we are interacting with one another. So that's the social field.
I want to say this about the social field, and I go to a grocery store that's right next to, it's a employee-owned grocery store. And I walk into that grocery store. I love shopping there because it feels good. It's a social field that feels good. And right next to that is a CVS store. And if I go over to CVS, it's such a different quality.
Exactly.
So I think we've all experienced moments like that in our social field, in the way we, when we shop or when we're interacting with the whole environment around us.
Yeah, exactly. That's a great example.
That's beautiful. The social field is a space that interactions that are both visible and invisible taking place. So when Mary starts by saying it involves the people in it, that's absolutely a starting place. The social field is understood because human beings are involved. And so the human beings in the room are a starting place. Each brings their personal field. And then Mary was pointing to something that there's a transcendent function. The group energy is not simply an addition of the individual energies. Some next level of energy is created by that group that may not be conscious to any one individual in the group. The group may be behaving in a way as a conscious entity, without the consciousness of the individuals in it.
Does this have something to do with, I know that you mentioned in your writing, murmuration.
Yeah.
And does this have, describe what murmuration is, and there might be social murmuration, but there, murmuration in birds.
Yeah. We use the metaphor of the starling murmuration because of all of the different birds that flock. The starlings are particular in being able to create these massive shapes in the sky, and they have been studied. How could they be doing this at a biological level? What is their what is the fields that they're, you know, responding to? But the remarkable thing is when you actually see something, either in either photographed or in person, there's a sense of awe and wonder. How could thousands, sometimes 10,000s of birds be moving simultaneously as one entity?
It's like they're dancing in the sky, but there are thousands of them performing this choreography.
And the social murmurations is along the lines of what you were pointing to, that we start individually, but then together we start creating a shape. You know, the atmosphere is a kind of shape. The energy in the room is a kind of shape that then begins to affect the individuals in it. And so to be able to be noticing this, a colleague said to me last night, this work on fields is really just changing me. I was in a group, he was the oldest person. It was a group of young men and women. And they just got all whiplash, like this idea, that bouncing off of each other. And he just said, I noticed it. And when I spoke, I purposely spoke in a slower tone. I reflected on what I was feeling listening to them all. I asked them to think about their own experience of the energy that we were creating together. And he said it changed the whole thing. It's like it went from an unconscious behavior to people becoming settled and conscious.
I love that because as Westerners, we tend to jump in right away and we're just like pinging off of one another so fast. But not all cultures, it does not respect the diversity of the people in the room, I would say.
Yeah.
Absolutely. When I was part of a women's international dialogue in the 90s, there were women there from South Africa, both Black and of European descent, as well as people from Japan and the United States and Europe and so on. And there was a moment when one of the women from South Africa, a Black woman from South Africa, and remember, this is early 90s. This is when Nelson Mandela was just released from prison, and it wasn't clear whether the whole country was going to go into civil war or not. But thanks to Nelson Mandela and other things that happened, that did not happen. So this woman, I'll never forget it. We were just what you were saying, Justine, that, you know, the Westerners going back, you know, jumping back and forth, ping-ponging, and it was supposed to be a dialogue, right? So it wasn't really being true to the essence of a dialogue. And her name was Wendy, and she said, you know, I don't understand what you're doing. When I listen to someone, I have to take it in through my eyes and ears and mouth, and it goes down through my body into my belly before I can respond. And so the room just shifted immediately. I mean, similar to Alan's story, because she was doing was bringing to our attention the social field we were creating unconsciously. And it all changed. We all slowed down.
Exactly. Yeah. And we have to pay attention to that if we're going to be an inclusive society in some way. The third field that you describe, and as you say, nothing exists by itself. Nothing. Yeah. It's not about that. But let's talk about the noetic field.
Well, I'll say a few things and then let Alan talk about the etymology of those terms. That noetic for me is about the wisdom in nature and the wisdom in cosmos. And I know that when I am in the Redwood Forest here, the ancient Redwood Forest that I am privileged to live in, that there is a wisdom and an energy. As soon as I walk into the woods, my body shifts to a very different place inside me of a kind of a knowing, a groundedness, a calm, and a sense that I am a small part of a much greater whole. And one could say that the noetic field actually is the all-encompassing field.
Beautiful. I want to say something a little more about the social field as it transitions, and we talk about the noetic, which is what is invisible in the social field is how we've internalized the history of our culture. So the notion of patriarchy, which goes back thousands of years, you know, that somehow men should be in charge. But even beyond patriarchy is the notion that you need a strong leader in order to maintain stable relations in your group. And this is being challenged by what we're understanding about collective wisdom, you know, that stability comes from distribution of voices, distribution of effort and contribution. But we still have internalized that dominant hierarchical, patriarchal notion. And it shows up in all kinds of ways, but it's the invisible dimension of virtually any social group.
I want to add here a comment, because what you're saying is so important. And if we followed the news, like we're recording this in November of 2025, and we've just had a big election, an off, what would you call it? Midterm election. And it was a huge blue wave. And then on all the media, they said, who's going to be the leader of the Democratic Party? And more and more people are saying, hey, it's not just one leader. It's different factions. And is that what you're trying to say?
That's exactly right. And what you're pointing to is how many different ways we become complicit in igniting the old paradigm. It's like you can't ever get away from it. Someone's going to remind you that there has to be someone in charge, whether it's the media or, you know, someone you're talking to. So we're getting at how the social field recreates itself from these embedded, more invisible aspects.
How can we trust then the social field as leaderless?
I think it was Thich Nhat Hanh who talks about how when the Buddha returns, that he will come back as a community. So I think that's what you're pointing to, Justine, you know, which for me is another aspect. And then Alan, please pick up on the noetic, that the notion that, and for me, fields is a doorway into actually knowing experientially how interconnected we are. So, Angelus Arian used to talk about the universal dynamic in groups is who's included and who's excluded. And so I think with the kind of field language and sensing into fields, I think it really jumps over in a way that dilemma of who's included and who's excluded, because we can actually feel how interconnected we are in a social space, which to me is directly related to the noetic field. So, Alan, if you want to pick up on that.
Well, that's exactly right. The transitions that we're making is there's a dilemma. The dilemma is that we each personally construct our world based on both conscious and unconscious factors that we can never fully know. So how do people get along when, you know, everyone has personally constructed their world and we can sort of forget about objectivity at that point? Everyone's just operating from their particular way of constructing the world. The noetic suggests that that's an error, that what we don't recognize is that beneath and above, we're connected, and that we don't easily access those connections because we don't slow down, because we don't examine where our thoughts come from.
I want to remind our listeners that I'm here with Mary Janinas and Alan Briskin, and they are the co-authors of Space is Not Empty, how hidden fields are shaping your life and our world. And if you want to know more about their work, you can go to their website. Alan is alanbriskin.com. He spells his name A-L-A-N-B-R-I-S-K-I-N, alanbriskin.com.